Hello everyone, I think we are ready to start. This session is Protecting Your Organization with Exchange Online Protection. I'm Andrew Stobart and I am an Implementation Project Manager with Microsoft. The title's a little deceiving. I'm not really a project manager, but I work with customers that are brand new to EOP. I work with them for up to 90 days, help them deploy the product, do any troubleshooting they might need. And at the very end of this session, I have a slide where I'll talk about my role and if any of you are in the position where you might be implementing very soon, how you can get in touch with us and have that resource. It's a free resource if you have purchased the licenses. So any time you have a talk like this, speaking coaches will always say, start off with some kind of a story, something that relates to the audience, maybe something that's a little bit funny. I'll tell you, I'm not really that funny, and some of the stories might seem a little bit pushed, so I decided to do something a little bit more unique, and on my plan right down here, I wrote a little bit of a poem, and I haven't seen anyone start off their session with a poem yet, so I think this is fairly unique, and so I'm going to read this, and hopefully you enjoy it. And it's not memorized, so excuse my reading. An ode to EOP at TechEd. Hello to you, my TechEd friends. Thank you for joining me here. Today we will learn of a wondrous service, and you'll see there's nothing to fear. Email can sometimes come with spam, and if you're not careful, a computer infection. Lucky for you, we can prevent those two with Exchange Online Protection. EOP is a breeze to deploy. There's really nothing to it. So listen closely and don't leave early, and you'll soon learn how to do it. Add one domain or up to 900, then create a connector or two. Now point your MX over to us, and like that, we're protecting you. Now let's begin this breakout session. Silence those phones that are in your pocket. And next time you log into O365, you'll really be able to rock it. So that is my unique intro. Thank you very much. I was hoping I would get an applause and not a laugh, but I was prepared for that. So Exchange Online Protection, I'm going to refer to it a lot as EOP, comes in not really two flavors, but if you have Exchange Online, it's part of that product. You'll be able to benefit from it. Conversely, you can buy it as a standalone product and protect on-prem mailboxes. And the big, big benefit of protecting on-prem mailboxes is that we'll do all the mail cleaning for you, and so the mail that passes to your on-prem environment is only the clean messages, and anything that needs to be dropped or NDR'd, we can do it at our end, so therefore reducing load on your on-prem servers along with bandwidth. So currently, EOP processes about 1 billion messages every day. And if you do the math, this works out to be almost 12,000 messages every second. And as big as that number is, it was actually closer to about 4 billion a few years ago. And back in that time, the botnets were just out of control. They're going crazy. Tons of spam messages were out there. So we've been really aggressive trying to shut down these botnets and the sources of spam. And since then, we have seen the number of spam messages drop. Unfortunately, it's not quite so easy in that although the number of spam messages has dropped, the sophistication of the spam campaigns is getting more and more sophisticated. So it's really a leapfrog game where we really have to try to stay ahead of the spammers and what they're doing. So in this session, it's really geared around the deployment of EOP, how the deployment goes, and then we're going to talk about some gotchas, some interesting tidbits with the service, some things you may not have realized. And actually with that being said, how many people have used EOP here at all before, either as standalone or Exchange Online? Okay, and who's never used it before? Okay, perfect. So I'm going to hopefully try to hit both groups of stuff that's interesting, but if you've never used it before, it's still going to be quite straightforward with the product. So a couple of things from this slide, starting off, the multi-engine antivirus. Every message that passes through EOP Typically, we will scan them with three different antivirus engines. Our SLA is two. Most of the time, it's three, but we have that leniency if we need to take one out, do any maintenance on it, if we're having any problems with one. One benefit of using the online antivirus engines is that they're updated continually. So if a new zero-day virus comes out, new definitions come out, we can update them on the fly, whereas a lot of antivirus programs on-prem, you'll get updated with DATs and definitions once a day. Geographically load balanced data centers, a lot of the Azure stuff has talked about this. It's the same thing with EOP and Exchange Online, where once you're in a data center within your region, we will never move your mail outside of that region. If we have problems with the data center, we may move it to a different data center within that region. But within that region, we're never going to move it outside of that region. As far as queuing capabilities go, if we have messages coming into the service, and whether they're being delivered to your on-prem or being delivered out to a partner, if we're not able to deliver those messages, we're going to queue them for up to 48 hours. And every 5 minutes, we're going to be retrying to do those. Now, let's say you have a problem with your on-prem servers, and we have a whole bunch of messages queued, and you're approaching that 48-hour mark. If you know you're going to have your servers up really soon and you don't want to hit that 48-hour mark, you can just call our support guys, and we'll bump up that time. So rather than NDRing a whole bunch of your messages, we will deliver them as soon as your servers come online. As far as the administration console goes, for those that have used it, the current wave of Office 365, we're calling Wave 15, it's the same look for all your products. So whether you're looking at administering SharePoint, EOP, Exchange Online, Link, it's the same view for everything. So when you're going from one product to another, it's very streamlined. It makes a lot of sense. It's a really slick look. So I'm not going to really talk about this slide too much. It's really, EOP is backed by financially backed by SLAs. We are very confident in the product, and if it's not performing up to snuff, it is financially backed. So that's all this one is listing here. So I like to start off with talking about what happens when mail comes into the system. How do we process it? What order do we go about processing it? Why? So I'll start off here with a flow diagram. So mail that starts from that's originating on the internet hits EOP based on your MX records. Your MX record has to be changed to be pointing towards us. Once we get it, at our edge is where we do our edge blocks. We do IP edge blocks and sender edge blocks. And I'll talk about this a little bit later, but we highly discourage against daisy chaining services. So if you're using a competing service right now, I've seen a lot of customers that are lenient in moving their MX record over. They want to play with EOP, so they just daisy chain it. So they'll have mail. Maybe you're using something like Postini. Postini will get it. We'll relay it to EOP. Then EOP relays it on-prem. The problem with that is that we do a bunch of our spam detection based on sender IP. And when we're talking about the sender IP, we're only looking at the IP that is connecting to us. So if mail is being relayed, say, through Postini, even your on-prem environment or somewhere else, we're not going to be doing that level of protection based on the sender IP. So if you are looking into the service, I would highly recommend to get the full view of it, is have your MX or even a test MX pointed straight towards EOP. So after our edge blocks, we move on to our virus scanning. This is where we have the three engines. Sometimes we'll use two. Most of the time, it's three. And if we ever detect any malware, it is always dropped. You don't have any configuration options of saying, I want to have this through. We are always going to drop that. What you can configure is if you want anyone to be notified when that happens, whether it be an internal sender, an external sender, an administrator. So that's what you can control the service. But if anything is found, we're always going to drop it. After our virus scanning, we hit our policy enforcement. And this is really our exchange transport rules. So any transport rules you've written in the cloud that block attachments, restrict message sizes, anything like that, they take place here. And after this, we hit our spam protection. And the reason we do in this order is that if you have a transport rule that's safeless a domain or a sender, we're not even going to do this section. We're just going to skip over the spam protection section and deliver it straight to your on-prem environment or the cloud mailbox if you're in the cloud. Now, this diagram isn't 100% correct with the quarantine. Up here, I have two quarantines, a policy quarantine and a spam quarantine. In reality, it's really just one quarantine. But the reason I break it out is that if you are using the quarantine, whether you're using end-user spam notifications to allow end-users to release their own content from the quarantine, or something we just released direct end-user access to the quarantine. Anything that was placed into their quarantine by a transport rule, they won't be able to release. And the thinking behind that is that if an administrator has created a rule, say to blacklist the domain, you're probably not going to want an end user to be able to release it on their own. So that's why I've separated them out in this diagram. All the end users will have access to when they're looking at their quarantine is stuff that our spam engine has placed in there. So finally, after the spam protection, we deliver it to the corporate network. And from the corporate network, we have a loop where you can submit false positives and false negatives back to our spam analysts for analysis. And we can look and see why was something caught, maybe why was something wasn't caught. And this is something I highly, highly recommend doing, is submitting these back to us for analysis. If it's something you have to submit back to us, it's obviously something that we've missed our mark on. But by submitting it back to us, it helps us get even better. And hopefully next time around, we will be able to catch it. One example where this can be, where this really, really helped us was a few months ago, someone submitted a piece of spam that got through the system. We had missed it, submitted it back to us, and our spam analyst added a global rule that would stop that message from coming in. It was over the next 24 hours, we blocked this message 5 million times across the service. So that's just one example of where, of how valuable that feedback is to us. So moving on, we have outbound filtering. And if you have an on-prem environment, this is completely optional. Some customers like having their mail going out through us, others don't. One benefit is that you don't have to worry about the reputation of your IPs by sending out through EOP. That's our concern. We're worrying about the reputation of our IPs, not you. So it's very similar to incoming. We start off on our corporate network. We first hit virus scanning. This works the same. We then move over to our policy enforcement. So if you have any rules, you want to add disclaimers, you want to restrict what people are sending out, that can take place here. If you're using DLP, this is the same place where those rules would apply. And again, stuff from here can be dumped into the quarantine. Next section, we have spam. So we're doing our spam detection, but we're not. If we detect something that is spam, we're going to send it out slightly differently. We're not necessarily not going to send it out. So after we do this, let's say the message has a good spam, a good score, it's safe, it doesn't look like spam. We send these out of our good normal mail IP pools, and these are IPs that are, we really take the reputation of these IPs seriously, and we continually monitor blacklists out there on the internet. We don't want these IPs to be to look bad. But let's say someone's sending a message out that looks like spam. Well, instead we're going to send this at what we call our high-risk delivery pool. And the high-risk delivery pool contains IPs that they look spammy on the internet. They're probably on some block list. If you have mail going out of here, you're going to want to figure out why, and if it's not legitimate, submit those back to us to make sure that doesn't happen, because anything that's delivered out the high-risk delivery pool may not make where it's going. Now, something that was announced at MEC about a month ago was that we are expanding the number of high-risk delivery pools we have. So now we now have an NDR delivery pool that's active, and a bulk delivery mail pool is coming. And the reason we're splitting these up is that, let's say we're sending an NDR out, let's say we're sending bulk out. We don't necessarily need that mail to be marked into the same group as spam does. So we want to separate these out. And one thing that we're thinking of is with the NDR delivery pool as well as the bulk, those IPs are probably not going to rotate. For a high-risk delivery pool, we continually rotate those IPs as reputation degrades on the internet. We're going to swap IPs in there. That's one of the reasons why we don't post them, is because they're continually rolling over. However, with bulk or NDR, theoretically, those ones shouldn't be as offensive as the high risk. So those IPs are ones that we should be able to publish. And that's something we're currently thinking about. That's not quite in place yet, but something we're thinking about. So I'm going to start off here just by talking about the general deployment, how that looks, and then we're going to go into some demos. A question? The question was, can you be notified if something goes out the high-risk delivery pool? We don't currently support that. That is feedback we've heard. But if you do a message trace on the service, our message trace will show if a message has gone out the high-risk delivery pool. So you kind of have to rely on an end user. An end user would have to let you know, hey, I sent a message. I don't think it got there. And if you do a message trace, our message trace is going to call out that it was sent out of high risk. So starting off here with the deployment process, very, very straightforward. We typically have three different scenarios we see when we're deploying EOP. Standalone doesn't necessarily mean you have mailboxes on-prem. They could actually be hosted anywhere, and as long as they're not in Office 365, they're considered, this would be considered standalone. So you could have mailboxes hosted with Google and using EOP to protect it. Standalone EOP is purchasable on its own. It also comes part of Exchange Enterprise CalWIS services. The next scenario, fully hosted, obviously all your mailboxes are in Exchange Online. EOP is part of that product. End of story. Hybrid is where we have mail servers on both sides, some in the cloud, some on-prem. The nice thing about EOP is that as you move through the three of these, typically customers will start out in standalone, protecting their on-prem environment, move up through hybrid as they're moving mailboxes to the cloud, and then finally end up in fully hosted, is that your configuration transitions between all of the steps. You don't have to copy your configuration, move it up. As you go from one step to the other, everything stays the same. You have your new licenses, and everything looks good. So these are the steps we're going to go through with our deployment. We have prerequisites. They're very straightforward. They'll probably take you about 30 seconds to verify, but we do have to discuss them. Step two, configuring mail flow. And with connectors, this is really creating our connectors within Exchange Online, as well as our on-prem connectors if we are wanting to send mail up through EOP when we're sending it out. Adding and validating domains, this is really all about us verifying that whatever domain you want to add to the service, you actually do own. We don't want you to add a domain, obviously, that you don't own and start sending mail on their behalf. Step four is where you're going to spend most of your time customizing the spam policy, and we're going to go in details in there and what's available. Step five, enabling mail flow. This is where we change our MX record to point towards EOP. And finally, monitoring fine-tuning. Is the service working as it should? Do we need to make changes to it? Do we need to tighten up the service? Do we need to loosen it up? So starting off with prerequisites, these are all very basic. One thing I do want to point out is that when you first create your tenant, you're going to have some name, .onmicrosoft.com, and this name is set in stone. We've had a lot of requests to change it. I've seen some customers that have, IT guy wants to test the service out, creates a tenant, we'll call it something like IHateMyBoss.onmicrosoft.com, all their configurations in there, and they figure they're going to be able to change this name, and they come to us, and this is not something we do. So if you are creating a brand new tenant, just name it something that's not going to be embarrassing. So if you have to give people other logins, it's going to be okay. Licenses, we obviously need either the XO or the EOP. Standalone, XO is short for what I call Exchange Online. Domain to migrate. If you really, really can, please use a test domain. I've seen a lot of customers that will just move full blast into production. And while I do like running on fire and I do have a tendency of making changes in production, I highly recommend you don't if you can help it, and using a test domain to test. As far as the modern web browser goes, Internet Explorer 8 and up is supported. If you're using the modern version, that'll work with most tasks, but some tasks you'll have to move to the desktop version. And as far as other support, we call it support for Chrome, Firefox, Safari. We just recommend you use the most recent version of those browsers. For the items that are applicable to standalone and hybrid scenarios, obviously we need all the IPs of your on-prem servers. We also need to have port 25 opened up to the EOP IP addresses. So we do publish the IP addresses that we'll use to deliver mail from EOP to your on-prem environment. Highly, highly recommend you lock your firewall down to these IPs if you're using EOP so that someone who's spamming cannot connect directly to your mail server and send messages in and bypass EOP. We obviously need to know stuff about TLS if you're using TLS. And directory synchronization may need other hardware. If you're using DirSync, DirSync has to be installed on a domain join machine, but it can't be installed on a domain controller. So depending on your setup, you may need some additional hardware for that. Configuring Mailflow, again, this is about the connectors. Standalone, we have two connectors in the cloud we need to create, one to deliver mail to your on-prem, one to receive from your on-prem. And from your on-prem servers, we need one connector that's going to send out to EOP. For hybrid, there are a lot of different scenarios we can get into, especially when we're talking about centralized mail flow. If you want to have mail routing to your on-prem first, then up to the cloud, and any mail that's leaving the cloud, you may want to have it routing to your on-prem and then out. I just recommend use the hybrid configuration widget to do all those setups because it covers a lot of those. Optional items for connectors, if you are setting up TLS connectors, if you do want to use TLS, that is all done through connectors. So talking a little bit about connectors, very, very high level, we have here, you know, brand new tenant, Exchange Online protection on the left. We have our on-prem environment on the right. When we're setting up our connectors, the connectors you see here on the screen are our connectors within Exchange Online protection. And one thing that to note here is that the naming convention of the connectors online is from Exchange Online protection's point of view. So when we're talking about an outbound connector, that's mail that's leaving EOP, but that's actually incoming mail to your environment. Conversely, if you're talking about outgoing mail from your environment, we need to configure an inbound connector because that's mail coming into EOP. So you just need to remember that the convention is done from the EOP point of view, not your on-prem point of view. You don't need to configure internet-facing connectors. We just do that. So any mail that's leaving your environment, the connector's there, it's hidden, you can't make any changes to it, we're going to send mail out. But if you want to create a TLS connector for a partner, this is done really the same way that your on-prem connectors are created, except that when you create your connector, you set the type to partner, and then you can enforce TLS in there however you'd like. We have a number of options for that. This is an interesting case. I actually came across a customer, and we had this set up recently, that a TLS setup, once they were moved over to EOP, a lot of their TLS broke. And so high level, before they had implemented EOP, what would happen was Contoso here on the left and Fabricam on the right, they're setting up their TLS connection. When they're doing their certificate exchanges, Contoso will send and say, here's my certificate. It's mail.contoso.com. Great. Fabricam sends its TLS certificate. It's mail.fabricam.com. And now a lot, actually most of the customers I see that are using TLS don't restrict on the certificate name. They will check to make sure the certificate's valid. They'll make sure it's signed by a trusted CA, but they won't actually restrict by that name. Now, this one customer I had that ran into problems here, them and their partners were restricting by their certificate name. So when they were sending mail TLS, they were checking and making sure that cert name was exactly there. So now we put EOP in the midst, and the problem they ran into was that now Contoso wants to send a message. Contoso says, here's my certificate. It's mail.contoso.com. And now it's expecting to get back Fabricam certificate, but because EOP's in the mix, it's not getting that back. So now EOP replies with its certificate, mail.protection.outlook.com. So if you are implementing TLS and you have any partners that are restricting based on the certificate that's being presented, they need to update their connectors with this information because this is a certificate they're going to see. And as of right now, we don't have a means of allowing you to upload your own certificate to EOP. We're always going to present this certificate. And then same thing on the other side, when you're sending mail to and from EOP, we're going to be presenting our certificate again. And I have a cool demo I'm going to show you in just a couple slides about that. So next up, when we're talking about connectors, let's say we have a global organization or even an organization that has their mail endpoints in different locations. We can set up multiple outbound connectors within EOP to deliver to those endpoints. If it's done by domain, it's really easy. You set up your connector, scope them that I want this domain over here, end of story. If you want to get a little bit more complex, this is one place where directory synchronization can come into place. You have directory synchronization, and EOP can make mail flow decisions based on Active Directory attributes. So you can create what we call is a criteria-based connector. You can create a transport rule that says if this is going to a user and they have an Active Directory attribute of APAC or America or whatever you want to go by, that's how we're going to route it. So if you want to distribute that load based on where both the user's mailbox might be, this is a way to do it. And on the other side of that, when you're creating your inbound connector, unless you want to do something really, really sneaky or really different, you only need one inbound connector unless you want to force TLS and you're scoping by certificates and all your endpoints have different certificates. Most of the time, you can create just one inbound connector, and you can create multiple, but I find by creating one, it just really cleans up the experience. So let's talk about one of the sections, our Mailflow tab right now. Sorry, that's my 9 months old. So let's say we are deploying EOP and we want to know the minimum steps to deploy it. We have our domain that's added here, eopdemo.com. I actually just registered this domain literally 2 days ago. So I've added it here to the service, so it's ready to accept. One thing you'll notice, and if you've used a service, you may have seen this, is a setup and progress. When you're adding domains to the service, the wizard is really geared around assuming that you're going to have all your services hosted with us. So as you're going through the wizard, right at the very end, we say, here's the DNS records you need to add to your domain to make your domain work with us. Now, if you're standalone, the two you're going to care about is the MX record, obviously, as well as the SPF record. But we're also going to give you an auto-discover record, which you're not going to want to change, because if you're using Exchange on-prem and have an auto-discover record set up, you're going to break that. As well as there's another CNAME address we give that really relates to other, if you're using Link Online or SharePoint Online. So now the problem with the wizard is that if you don't add all four of those DNS records, it's not going to let you continue. So that's something that is broken right now, something we're working on fixing, but at that point in the wizard, you just cancel out of it. And you will see this setup in progress until we have this fixed, but your domain is going to work just fine with the service. So now I'm going to flip over to the Exchange part here. I haven't timed out. So next up, if we look at connectors, we create an outbound connector here in EOP, and that's all we need to do to have the service set up for us. It's obviously going to be very vanilla setup, but as soon as the MX record is changed for that domain, we're going to start accepting mail on your behalf. And if you want to have mail sent out through us, then that's where we have the inbound connector. And one thing that is not really quite straightforward, I'll just show you on this inbound connector here, is I see a lot of customers with this kind of a setup where they want to force TLS. So any mail that comes from their on-prem environment going to EOP, they want to force TLS, so they have force TLS selected. They have their certificate name, whatever it might be, typed in there. But under domain restrictions, they have set to none. So in this case, although you have a certificate typed in there, we're actually not checking the certificate that you present to us. You could present us any certificate as long as it's valid, as long as it's signed by a trusted CA, we're going to accept it. In this case, if you do want us to restrict and only accept mail from your specific certificate, then you have to come up here under domain restrictions and select restrict domains by certificate. By default, that's set to none, and I see a lot of customers that have a certificate typed in, domain restrictions set to none, and don't realize that we're actually not checking for that certificate that they have typed in there. Looking at accepted domains, another new feature that we added to the service recently is something we call directory-based edge blocking. This is something that was available in our previous product, FOPI, but was not something initially when we launched EOP that was available. And what this does is if you're using directory synchronization and syncing up to us, if a spammer is trying to guess at email addresses in your organization, if you turn on directory-based edge blocking, we're going to block those messages right at EOP rather than forwarding them to your on-prem having to create the NDR for them. So that's something that we just launched, not just launched, about a month ago. And to configure that, underneath the accepted domains, you just need to change your domain to authoritative and make sure directory synchronization is working. If you are set up like this, by default, directory synchronization runs every 3 hours. So if you are in this state, if you create a brand new mailbox, it's not going to work with EOP until dir-sync takes place, because any messages sent into EOP for that, we're not going to know about, so we're going to end up bouncing them. So it's just something to be aware of if that is one feature you are looking at using. Yeah, so you turn on authoritative and make sure you're using dir-sync as well, because anything that's not directory synced up, we're going to assume that mailbox doesn't exist. Message Trace has had some other good enhancements. For those of you with the service who have used Message Trace and wish it showed more details, I'm assuming you're lying because message trace does not show a lot of details. So something that we've added we call extended message trace. And just by looking at the GUI, it's not extremely straightforward whereabouts it is. So if I just do a search here, this is going to show me any messages that have passed through the service. One instance here, we can see this message failed. I can come in here, and this is not all that informative. I can see it failed, but why did it fail? Something wrong with the server, something wrong with the service, what's going on? So previously, you'd have to phone in to our escalation engineers. They could tell you what's going on. But with our message trace, we now have what we call an extended message trace. And what is not super called out here is to access this, you have to set your day range to be custom. And then once you set that, you have to set your start date to be more than a week old. So if you watch at the bottom of the screen here, when I click on May the 6th, I suddenly get this extra dialogue down here. So this is all called out in TechNet, but if you're looking at the GUI, it is not straightforward that this is where it is. And so here what we can do is we can still do our regular message trace. I want to select include message events and routing details with the report. And this isn't it's not going to return results right away. This is going to submit a request to our back end, and then we'll send you an email when the report is ready and you'll download it as a CSV file. Typically, it takes about 45 minutes for you to get a report from what I've seen. And the CSV file that you get is essentially exactly what our escalation engineers look at if you call in and say, what's going on with this message? There's a couple of columns you're not going to see in there, but essentially everything that they need to tell you what's going on with the message is in here. It gives you all of the SMTP codes, if a mail server is responding but not accepting. So this is something that's really, again, really powerful, but something that is really kind of hidden. I'll show you just a quick example of what one looks like. When they come back, they can look really quite intimidating. There's a lot of stuff in here. I'm not going to go through how to parse one, but I would recommend focusing on one message ID at a time. And then you can create a macro that would really nicely clean this up, and then sorting by date, and then you can see exactly what's going on. So if you are troubleshooting something, this is a really, really good place to start. Not going to talk about delivery reports. A couple of things with rules. So this is where we'd create all of our rules with all of our policy enforcement. Do we want to block attachments? Do we want to block restrict based on message sizes? Whatever we want to do. And one thing that I would always recommend doing in here is at the bottom here, we have a link that says more options. So before we click that, as I go through the GUI, everything is just single entry of what I can do. Clicking on that's going to bring up another window and say, okay, well, what do you want to do? Almost like a wizard type of thing. But if we click on more options and now drop down in here, this really shows us everything the system can do. So every option here has a breakout menu of what it can contain, what it can do. So it's a lot easier way of looking at what the service is available of doing. One thing I will caution is that if we look under any attachment, has executable content is obviously a really good one if you just want to stop executable content. One of these ones to be aware of is content can't be inspected. So content can't be inspected will catch stuff, say if it's a weird compression that we don't recognize, if there's a password on a zip file or a RAR file. The problem with this one is that as of right now, EOP will recognize JPEG files, but we don't recognize GIF files or PNG files. The problem with that is that a lot of people have images in their signatures, and they are GIF and PNG files. So if you have a rule set up that says if content can't be inspected, drop a message, NDR, move it to the quarantine, whatever, it's going to trigger on everyone that sends a message that has a PNG or GIF in their signature. So just something to be aware of in that, and that is more feedback that we've heard that we should be looking at those types as well. But this is one item that if you do use that can have those problems. Yeah. Sorry, can you repeat that? Correct. Yeah, question was, we'll look in zip files. Zip files we do support, so if there's anything within a zip file, we will open up that zip file, scan it. If it's encrypted or password protected, then we can't do that. So this is a rule that would catch that. You can mix and match these rules. So you could say if content can't be inspected and the recipient is outside the organization, then take an action. And that would allow someone internally to send messages with those pictures and they won't get caught. So before I move on, I'll show you one other thing, and I think this is really cool. My background is really operations. The last role I did, I was a big server guy, did a lot of troubleshooting with servers. And so when I was telling you before about the certificate that we present, yeah, you can look on TechNet and see what certificate we present. You could ask someone like me. You can ask an escalation engineer. But if you're someone like me, you want to see that yourself. You want to see, well, what certificate are we presenting? So I pulled out my trusty tool of Wireshark and captured a connection between my Exchange server that I have running in a lab, communication up to EOP. So I'm going to just trim this down. Oops. So here, and I will zoom in once I get down here, here I'm looking at the port 25 traffic between my server and Exchange Online Protection. So if I look here, this is the start. I have my server hello, the certificate request. And if I drill down here to see what is going on with this packet, I can actually see here, my zooming in is not working. But you can see that I have right here, the common name equals mail.protection@outlook.com. So that's just kind of one cool way of seeing that if you want to prove it to yourself and you don't want to take my word for it, that's the certificate that we pass because this is an actual session that I captured talking to Exchange Online Protection. So coming up next, we have our domain validation. So I talked about this a little bit before, why we do the validation. And the validation is typically done, you can do it two ways. You can either change your MX record, which I highly recommend against doing, or we'll give you a text record to add to the DNS for that domain. Once you've added it to your DNS, come back to the wizard and say, check now. Once we see that text record entered for your domain, we'll mark the domain as validated, and you're able to use that domain with EOP. And on the slide, I also call out that setup and progress part at the bottom, where if you see that, it's really not a problem. As long as you pass the domain validation part of the wizard, and there's another part of the wizard where it asks you, what do you want to do with this domain? And there's a little checkbox that says something like, I want to use this domain to protect on-prem environment. Make sure that's checked off, and as long as you're past that, your domain is going to work just fine with the service. Spam and policy customization. So EOP categorizes spam in two categories. We have what we just call is spam and what we call high confidence spam. Now, most of the spam that we catch is going to be spam. A smaller part of it is going to be high confidence spam. But that will also depend on how you tune the service. If you make our filters more sensitive for your product, you may see, or sorry, for your tenant, you'll see more items in the high confidence spam rather than just regular spam. We'll take a look at this after a couple of slides. Configuring the sensitivity of the spam detection, we have what we call advanced spam options, and you can turn on different items in here that will make the service more sensitive. You can turn on items like if you see a URL with an IP address, well, let's mark that as spam. If you see a URL that points to a non-standard port, mark that as spam. Those types of options. So these are things you can turn on with a service that will make it a little bit more sensitive. There's also one option in there that can be a little bit dangerous called an SPF hard fail. So if that's turned on, any message that comes in that's directed to you that produces a hard fail on the SPF check, we're going to mark that as spam. Now, that's great, but I've seen that there's a lot of domains out there that have either incorrectly published SPFs or out-of-date SPFs, and so legit mail coming in could hard fail an SPF check and therefore be marked as spam. So that's one option I'd recommend not turning on unless you're seeing a lot of spoofing coming into your environment, in which case it may outweigh the cons of having that option turned on. Setting company policy. We talked a little bit about the transport rules. This is essentially all done in the transport rules, whether it's safe listing a domain, blacklisting a domain, limiting message size, attachments, those sorts of things. And then malware and outbound spam, we're going to get into a little bit more at the next demo. I'm not going to go through exactly how this works, but when you're setting up your spam actions of what you want us to do when we detect spam, you can do things like move the message to the quarantine, move it to the My Junk Mailbox folder, drop it, add an X header, redirect it to a mailbox. If you want to have that message moved to your junk mailbox folder and you have your mailboxes on-prem, what happens is any message that passes through EOP, we stamp it with a header, x-forefront-antispam-report will be stamped onto every message that passes through us. If we find spam, we will, within that header, mark that it was junk mail and then forward it to your on-prem environment, just like any good mail. So if your on-prem environment isn't looking for those headers that we add, most likely those messages are just going to be dropped in 10 users' inboxes, and our service is going to look really, really bad. So if you are using the junk mailbox folder on-prem, make sure that those two rules are added. This is PowerShell. This will work with Exchange 2013. I think it needs to be tweaked a little bit for Exchange 2010. And older, you'll probably need to manually create the rules. But essentially, all we're looking for is within that header, you either see SFV colon SPM or colon SKS. And that'll indicate that we have marked it as spam. SFV stands for a spam filter verdict. Here's an example of one of the headers that we have added to a message. This one came to a message that we marked as spam. I've removed the IP addresses in here, but highlighted in red some of the more interesting bits. So the first one, the IPV colon NLI, indicates that this was sent from an IP that was not on our block list. So this came in OK. It was something down the chain that marked it as spam. The SFV I'd mentioned is a spam filter verdict. Here we see SPM, so we've marked it as spam. If you saw an SPM, that would mean we'd marked it as not spam. If you saw SFE, someone had safe listed it. BLK means it wasn't safe listed. And the link I have at the bottom here describes a lot more of what you can find in there and what exactly those headers are. The SFS is the spam filter score, and you see a whole bunch of numbers. Those are not readable. Those are only understandable by our spam analysts. So any message that you submit back to us for analysis, something that was either we missed spam or marked it incorrectly, that's what they would use to figure out what exactly did our engine do and what actually either caused us to be marked as spam or what didn't cause it to be marked. And then finally, at the very bottom in red, I have the SCL. So here we had an SCL of 5. When you're doing troubleshooting and trying to figure out why a message was marked as spam or why it wasn't, that's also a really good place to look. If a message was safe listed somewhere, you'll see an SCL of -1. So if a message got through, maybe it was safe listed accidentally, either by IP or by domain. If you see a 0 or a 1 in there, it means that we did do spam scanning on it, but we deemed that the message was safe. If you see a 5 or a 6, that means that the message was marked as spam. And finally, a 9 means it was marked as high confidence spam. And all the numbers in between, we don't use with the service. If you are using the quarantine, there's really three different ways you can use it. You can have messages go to the quarantine and only allow administrators to remove them. Another way you can do is what we call an end user spam notification, which is really like a daily digest. So if you have a huge user base, you don't want administrators to spend time combing through the quarantine, but you don't want to use a junk mailbox folder, this is one option where if a user has had mail destined to them that has wound up in the quarantine, we'll send a daily digest or an end user spam notification to them. And within that email, they have links for each spam messages to either release that message to the inbox or report it as not junk. And those do work independently. So if you report something as not junk, that actually doesn't release it to your inbox. And something that we've heard a lot of feedback on that we just launched a couple of weeks ago is end user access to the quarantine. So with our ESNs that I just talked about, the minimum amount of time between them being sent out is 24 hours. So if a user has just received an ESN, a message was destined to them, has wound up in the quarantine, they're going to have to wait 24 hours for that next ESN to come out for them to be able to release that message. With end user access to quarantine, an end user can go into the portal, release a message right away, and see that view in real time. And this is one example of what it looks like. And as I talked about at the beginning, we have those kind of two separate quarantines. So if you have a rule that's dumped something into the quarantine, it won't show up in this view, and it won't show up in that ESN view. As far as quarantine goes and the ESNs, a common question I get asked is about the delivery of those ESNs. Can we customize the time they get sent out? And unfortunately, at this point, you can't. Typically, what happens is on our servers at midnight UTC time is when we start up our ESN generation process. So we'll comb through all the tenants within that data center, send out our ESNs, and typically you'll see ESNs around the same point of the day, but this will fluctuate if we all of a sudden have a high number of ESNs that need to be generated, or another day we have a lot smaller number of ESNs that need to be generated. Got a question? You're talking about the end user access or ESN? Yeah, I'll show you. So the question was, do you turn on the quarantine? So I'll show you that when we get into the next demo of kind of where that's turned on and how you configure that. So finally, we've gone through everything. We're ready to enable the mail flow. Typically, not always, when we give you the MX records, they're going to be in this format. So we're going to have your domain-suffix.mail.protection.outlook.com. Don't assume that. I've had a couple customers that will assume that, you know, I know what MX is going to give me, change the MX, and it actually was wrong. So when you get that MX, make sure that you are looking within the 365 portal to get that. And one kind of tip, I guess, I'll give you with that is that, let's say you have a ton of domains you've added to the service. You've added 500 domains. You don't want to go through the process of pulling the MX record for every single domain you've added. You can actually use one MX record for every single domain that you have, and that's going to be fine. So you can take one domain, grab the MX record, and use that MX record for every other domain, and that's going to work just fine with your tenant. The one thing to watch is that if you do that, if you ever remove that domain from the Office 365 portal, it's going to break all your other domains. So if you do want to do that, pick a domain that you are not going to be removing from the service. The SPF record, we have an SPF record. It's the same for all tenants. If you're sending mail out through us, please have your MX, or sorry, your SPF record changed. And then I had called out before the other CNAME entries that if you're not using the other services with us, don't change them because you could break stuff. And then our on-premise changes if we are going to smart host out. I would recommend that if you are doing both of having incoming mail coming through EOP and outgoing mail, don't change it at the same time. I'm a big believer in not having a lot of changes done at one time, so break these up, even if it's just by a night. Have your direction changed one way, maybe your outgoing first, and then have your incoming change the next night, or vice versa. But unless you really have to have both changed in the same night, change them separately, so if anything does happen, it's going to be less moving parts to have to try to figure out which one broke. So let's take a look at the protection section here. So first up, we have the malware filter. And I mentioned earlier that we will always strip malware. You don't have a choice of whether it's retained or not. We're always going to strip it. So in here is where you can set your alerts, essentially. So by default, we're just going to drop the entire message. If you want alerting, you can either use default alert text, you can use customized alert text, and then you can decide, well, who do we want to notify? Do we want to notify internal senders? Do we want to notify external senders? Typically, I don't recommend external senders be notified, because if malwares come in, most of the time it's for malicious intent, and so why notify them? Or if we want just an administrator to be notified, we can set this up to have an administrator notified, and then again, we can set custom text in here and what happens. In the connection filter, this is where we do our IP allow and block list. And so if we are safe listing or block listing domains, that's done with transport rules. If we are safe listing or blacklisting IPs, it's done in the connection filter. And it's actually in a separate area because any IPs that we block are done right on our edge, whereas transport rules take place after we have processed the message a little bit. And one thing I'll point out here is right at the very bottom, enable safe list. This is something I always recommend to people I'm working with. Microsoft subscribes to good known senders, IPs, as well as we have our own internal list. And by checking this off, you're essentially adding that list to your tenant. So any mail that you have coming in that comes from one of the IPs that we've deemed as safe, we're going to treat it as safe, skip spam filtering, let it into your environment. We don't publish these IPs, and you won't see them listed in the portal here, just because these IPs are constantly changing. These lists are always changing, being updated, being refined. But in the customers I've worked with, I've seen a lot of cases where turning this on can really reduce the number of false positives that they're seeing. If they're seeing false positives, is by turning on the Enable Safe List. So the content filter, and I had a question before about the quarantine. To turn on the quarantine, there's really no on or off button, other than if you come in here and deciding for spam messages, I want them moved to the quarantine. Now anything marked as spam is going to be moved to the quarantine. Or if I have a transport rule set up that says if you see, you know, something from this domain or whatever criteria, move it to the quarantine, that message is going to be moved to the quarantine. So there's really no on or off switch. It's just, it's there, it's enabled. If you have the action set to move something to the quarantine, it's going to be moved to the quarantine. Yeah, so by default, when you first come in here, the default spam actions are move message to junk mailbox folder. So if you have not set any action set up, we're going to assume you want that message moved to your mailbox folder. International spam, if you want to restrict and mark messages spam either by the country they were sent from or the language, you can do that. And then our advanced options is what I was mentioning before, where you can toggle all these switches to make our service more sensitive to your needs. I always recommend leaving most of these off when you implement, just because if you turn all of these on, they can result in a lot of false positives. So some of these ones at the top, if a numeric IP address is in the URL, that's probably not a good thing, but then a lot of your IT folks will probably send emails with numeric addresses in the URL, and you're not going to want those to be marked as spam. So a lot of these kind of have a flip side, and you could get creative with doing something like turning on that you want something marked as spam if there's an IP in there, but then you create a transport rule that says, hey, if my IT staff has sent it, I want this to be safe listed, and if it's safe listed, it's never going to hit these rules. So you can kind of mix and match and do items like that. If you're using the quarantine, we talked a little bit about ESNs, or the end user spam notifications. If I'm looking at the default content filter here on the far right, we have this link, configure end user spam notification. And here's where I can enable it. And by default, it's set to be sent out every 3 days, which I think is way too many. I always recommend to restrict this down to one. You can create multiple content filters. So if you want to have different rules for different users, you can do that. And you can scope content filters either by domain, a user, or a group. So one thing to know is that if you create a content filter that is scoped to either a user or a group, we can see over here on the right-hand side of this other content filter, I don't have the option of turning ESNs on. And that's because the end user spam notifications can only be turned on if I have a content filter that's scoped to a full domain. So it's either on or off for that domain. If you do want to, say, turn on ESNs for a particular group of users or you want to test them, turn on ESNs, and any ESN that's sent out is sent through your tenant, and they're always sent from quarantine@messaging.microsoft.com. So what you can do is create a transport rule that will block all messages from that email address unless the user is so-and-so or unless the user is in this group. So that way, you can have ESNs turned on, but restrict who they are sent to. When we're looking at outbound spam here, this is super, super straightforward. We have two options, two text boxes here where we can type in either email addresses or a distribution list. The second one is really important. If an end user looks like they're compromised and is sending out mass amounts of spam through us, we will block that user. If we take that action, the second email address is where we're going to notify that one of your end users has been blocked. Here's how you would go about unblocking them once you figure out what the problem is. And the top one, if we detect something going out that looks like it might be spam, we're not sure, this is where we will notify you. And then we have the quarantine view. One thing to note about the quarantine view here is that it will only show you a max of 500 entries. We do keep back up to 15 days worth of messages in the quarantine, but through the GUI, we're only going to see up to 500 entries. So we can filter these down. We can filter this based on subject, by sender, by recipient. But in the end, we're only going to see 500. If you do need to see more, you can use PowerShell to connect to your tenant. And within PowerShell, you can grab every single one that you want. But through the GUI, you're only going to be able to pull up to 500. All right, so now everything has been implemented. Hopefully everything is going really good. We have our monitoring and fine-tuning. And this is really just where, is the service working like it should? Are we seeing false positives, false negatives? What's happening? Are we happy with it? As for tools that we can use, when we're talking about reports, there's two places of looking at reports for the service, through the web portal, or in the same spot in the web portal, on the right-hand side, there's a link that says mail protection reports for Excel. And this is a download you can use with Excel 2013 that will allow you to view your reports within Excel. This has a lot of benefits with it. This is one of the views of using the Excel sheets. So they're a lot more colorful. You can really change the data a lot more because it's in Excel, as well as when in Excel, you can pull data from up to 180 days back, whereas in the web portal, you can't go quite back so far. So depending on your needs, what you're looking for, you may want to look at the Excel sheets instead of the web-based reports. Another question I've been asked a lot with the reporting is, can we automatically send out reports, whether it's on a daily basis, a weekly basis? Again, this is something we don't currently support. We've heard a lot of feedback about this, something we're thinking about. But as of right now, if you want to report, you either need to jump into the portal and grab it, or use the mail protection reports for Excel. This is a quick look just at a few different services, Exchange Server 2013, Exchange Online, and Exchange Standalone. It's just an example of how our UI is really coming together. So especially for those that have used Exchange 2013, if you're moving up into the cloud, everything is going to be very familiar feeling with you. Even the transport rules are identical to what you can create on-prem with Exchange 2013. So the last section I have to talk about here is some best practices. Now, I gave this talk a couple of months ago, and this slide was a lot smaller, way smaller. And when I was updating this deck for this talk, I started adding some stuff in here, and I got a little bit too crazy, I think, with the slide. But a lot of best practices that I have run into. So firstly, use a test domain. Again, this is just to try to minimize hurt to users, downtime, any issues you may come into. Creating an Office 365 connector before adding your domain. This is just because when you go through your wizard to add your domain, the wizard is going to look to see if a connector is set up. And if it's not, you're going to have to jump out of the wizard, go create your connector. So if you've created it ahead of time, then you're not going to need to do that. This next one is actually quite interesting. Disabling your EOP inbound connector until you're ready to use it. Let's say you've gone into the service, you have set up an inbound connector and an outbound connector, but in particular, the inbound connector to accept mail from your on-prem that's being sent out, but it's going through EOP. But on-prem, you aren't smart hosting to EOP yet. On-prem, you're still sending out to whatever the MX record is. Now, you'll be in this state, you jump into EOP, you do a message trace, and are extremely surprised to see that a whole bunch of your outgoing messages are already going through the service, even though you have not started smart hosting to the service. So what's going on in this case is that if any of your users send mail out to partners that are hosted on Office 365, that message is going to get routed to EOP. And because you have a connector that says, if this IP sends mail, suck it into my tenant, we're going to suck that mail into your tenant. And so if you're still playing with the tenant, if you have rules added, maybe that add disclaimers or stuff that you don't want to take effect, just something to be aware of. I've seen that come up with quite a few customers that kind of pre-stage the environment and are not expecting messages that are being sent out of their environment to go through their EOP tenant and then are surprised to see that. So that's just something to be aware of. The Remote Connectivity Analyzer is a web-based tool we have. It tests connectivity. The biggest use of it that I use is that it comes with a header analyzer. So it's, I know there's a lot of them out there. This is just another place you can go for that. We talked about restricting your inbound SMTP access to only accept mail from our EOP published ranges, and the link I have on this slide will take you to that TechNet page. enabling the IP safe less than the connection filter. Again, this can really reduce the number of false positives that you see. And when you create safe and blacklists, if you can do it by IP, do it by IP first. If you can't, then do it by domain. But it's a lot harder for a spammer to change IPs than it is by domain. So if you can do it, by IP, I highly recommend doing that first. Don't do this. Daisy chain the services. I talked about that a little bit before. The biggest loss that you have when you are daisy chaining is that we won't be able to block messages based on the sending IP, even if it's been proxied by someone else. We're only going to see that connecting IP to us. Don't use EOP for sending bulk mail. If you have a need to send out newsletters, something less legit, it may go through the service, but it also may go out our high-risk delivery pool. If you have a need to send bulk mail, we recommend that you either, if you're sending it from an on-prem environment, have your on-prem environment send it out directly and not through EOP, or use a third-party bulk mailer. We talked about the advanced spam options. Don't recommend enabling all these out of the box. Turn them on a need-by-need basis. And then lastly, and I've seen this done quite often, don't safelist your own domain. So if you safelist your own domain, if someone starts spoofing you, that message is going to come through and pass all our spam filters because you've safelisted that. So please don't safelist your own domain. If you're still thinking about daisy chaining, this is quite an interesting slide. These numbers are very, very ballpark numbers. These change month to month. But just to give you an idea, 80% of all the messages we mark as spam comes from the sending IP. So that's just an indication of the bad IPs out there, just the mass amounts of spam that they're sending. I had a customer recently that was daisy chaining services. They had mail going to a third-party computing service, then to EOP, and then to their on-prem environment. And they were seeing a lot of spam coming through. And so I was looking at the spam coming through, and a good chunk of it was being sent from IPs that are on our block list. And so if their MX had been pointed straight to us instead of daisy chaining, those messages would have been properly marked as spam. Now, these messages or these numbers are going to change drastically with IPv6. Obviously, with IPv6, our ability to block an IP really goes down because spammers can easily change IP. But right now, when we're just looking at IPv4, these are the numbers. Again, very, very ballpark. Directory synchronization, if you're going into a hybrid mode, you probably already have this set up. If you're just doing EOP standalone, this can add a lot of benefits to the service. One of the biggest benefits that we had talked about is that you can use criteria-based routing. So this is if you want to do different routing depending on an Active Directory attribute. Another good feature that this adds is if you have groups in your local Active Directory, you can write transport rules in Exchange Online Protection that will trigger on that. So you can say, if a message is sent to a member of this group, take this action. And if the group membership changes, we're going to be aware of it, and you won't need to change that rule. So you can just manage those groups on your local Active Directory. Talked a little bit about directory-based edge blocking. Essentially, to turn this on, make sure you're using directory synchronization. Then you just set your domain type to authoritative. If you're fully hosted in the cloud, we're going to be doing this anyways. This is not something that you need to do. But if you have any on-prem servers and you want to stop mail coming in, this destined to mailboxes that just don't exist, the spammers are just guessing at, turn this on, and we will block those messages at our edge rather than forwarding them to your on-prem environment. Now, we do have time for this. So this is really quite cool. Oops. Let's say you're ready. You have EOP set up. You're ready to move your MX record, but you're a little bit worried about it. Moving an MX record takes time. There's a propagation time over the internet. If we then run into problems, it's a little bit, we then have that same propagation time to move backwards. If all we want to do is test mail flow to make sure that EOP can deliver mail to your on-prem and make sure our connectors are looking okay and make sure your on-prem is scoped to accept from EOP, we can use Telnet to test this out. And I'll show you an example of this, and this is nothing secret. This is how you would send mail using Telnet, but a lot of people don't realize that you can use this to test out EOP. And high level, what we're doing is the MX record that we want you to change your domain to. With Telnet, you connect directly to that MX record, send your message through, And then essentially what you're doing with that is you're injecting a message directly into your EOP tenant and bypassing the MX lookup. And then from there, now that the message is in there, it should flow properly to your on-prem environment if your on-prem environment's set up properly, if it's accepting mail from EOP. So this is a nice way of testing before actually making that MX change, and it's a way of seeing that stuff is going to work. It gives you a little bit more of that, you know, cuddly feeling that, you know, I think this is going to be okay and not such a scary feeling. So I'm going to show you just a really quick example of that, and then I only have a few more slides after that. So the test domain that I had registered here, I'm going to do a quick NS lookup on it. And I can see it has two MX records right now. Neither are pointing towards EOP. This is just what was added to it when I registered the domain. But this is the domain that I have added to my EOP tenant. I have my connector set up. I want to make sure this works. So one thing to note with doing this is that when you are connecting with Telnet, you're connecting on port 25. Now, a lot of ISPs block port 25, so this is not a test you'd be able to do. So you'd have to do this test from a server that is not having port 25 blocked. For this example, this is a machine that I have running up, a virtual machine I have running up in Azure, and it's not behind any restrictions. It has port 25 open to the internet, so I am going to show you this really, really quickly just because I think this is quite cool. So I'm going to telnet here to, and I haven't looked it up, so you'll have to take my word for it, eopdemo-com.mail.protection.outlook.com, and that is the MX record that my tenant has told me I need to give to this domain for mail to be routed properly to EOP. So I connect to that, and I made the connection, and now I just follow standard telnet commands to send a message. So I'm going to start with a hello. And our response is that it's OK. And then I'm going to say who my mail is from. I'm just going to use an invalid domain. I get that the sender was OK. Now who do I want to send to? It likes it. And so this is actually one section that, because I've connected to this tenant, if I said I want to send mail to a different email address, EOP would come back with an error and say, we don't relay, you won't be able to send this message. But because this domain is valid within the tenant that I've connected to, it's allowing me to progress. But again, EOP doesn't relay mail. So if I put an invalid email address in here, we're going to get an error back saying, we can't send that. So continuing along here, we do data. And then to end a message with Telnet, you use a period. And EOP comes back and tells me that the message has been queued for delivery. So I also have up here this box, which is another box that is, it's a virtual machine running up in Azure, but this is my Exchange server, and we can see the message is already here. This is the message that I just sent through Telnet, and if I look at the headers of it, I can see, and again, I'm sorry, I can't, my zooming in is being weird, but this is the X forefront header, so we can see that it did pass through EOP. EOP has stamped the anti-spam report on it. And if I look higher up in the headers, we can see that the message was accepted by EOP. So this is a really cool way of being able to test to make sure your connectors are working to deliver to your on-prem before you actually change your MX record. And again, this is nothing, there's nothing groundbreaking about this, there's nothing secret about this, but a lot of people don't realize that you can actually connect directly to that MX record. So I have just a couple more or a few more slides. This is kind of a unique case. When we're setting a transport rule, you can set what you want the SCL to be. If you want it safe listed, you'd say you want it to be minus one. But if you set it to zero, this is a special case. And if you set the SEL to zero for any message, this causes us to scan it with our spam engines. So one use case where you may want to do this, let's say you're in a hybrid setup, you have mail flowing to your on-prem environment first and then up to EOP, and you have mailboxes in both locations. What'll happen is you'll probably want to safe list the IPs of your on-prem mailboxes. So any messages that are sent from an on-prem mailbox to an EOP mailbox will be safe listed. The problem is that if you have a mail that originates from the internet and is relayed through on-prem up to the cloud, that's also going to be safe listed. So in that scenario, what you can do here is safe list that IP, but then create a transport rule that says, if any mail comes in from outside my organization, set the SCL to zero. And what that'll do is any mail that comes legitimately from your on-prem up to your up to the cloud will be safe listed, everything is good. If something comes from the internet and is relayed through your on-prem up to the cloud, we're going to set the SCL to zero, and this is going to cause us to scan those messages with our spam engines. I'm just going to buzz over this. We talked a little bit about the quarantine. If you want to see more than 500 messages, you have to use PowerShell. Another limitation is that through the GUI, you can't do a mass release. So if you have a bunch of messages that were quarantined by accident from the same sender, you can't do a mass release from the portal, but you can from PowerShell. So depending on what you need to do, you can do a lot more within PowerShell. And just quickly, improvements and investments. Since January of this year, these are all the additions we have made to the service. So the extended message trace, which I showed you, that's that little bit of a trick to get it to show up with the dates. Directory-based edge blocking and matched subdomains. Before that was added, if you had a parent domain and a bunch of subdomains, you'd have to add every single subdomain and validate it separately. Whereas now, as long as you have that parent, you can have all the subdomains validated automatically. Remote PowerShell was only available for Exchange Online customers and not EOP standalone customers. Now that's available. And user access to the quarantine was rolled out just a couple of weeks ago. And then we also have Office 365 message encryption, which is a policy-based message encryption for the service. Things that are coming soon, we have DKIM for inbound email, as well as support for IPv6. And then on our future roadmap, we have outbound DKIM and DMARC support, which is kind of a new generation of SPF checking, as well as improvements to our bulk mail advanced option filter. Right now, if you turn on, you can turn on one of our switches to stop block bulk mail, and we're going to allow you to be even more granular with that rather than just on and off. And lastly, I talked about my role. So we work with customers that are brand new to either EOP standalone or are going into a hybrid environment. We'll work with them for up to 90 days. If you've bought at least 1,000 seats of the product, we work with you for no charge. And we work with you on an as-need basis and help you help educate you about the product, any questions you may have. We're kind of that single point of contact where even if it's something that needs to be escalated, we can do that escalation for you rather than you needing to do that. So if you would like to engage with one of us, the easiest thing to do is talk to your TAM, your technical account manager, and they will get you in contact with us. So I have some related content, and for those that have downloaded the deck, I have some resources in here. They're really just linked to common TechNet links with stuff about EOP. So thank you very much for attending. That's it for me. And please fill out an evaluation. Let me know what you thought. Thank you.